wanted to escape. I didn't have my kids, and I needed to get away from the media and the paparazzi. I wanted to leave LA, so the photographer and I went on a trip to Mexico. It was like I'd fled to a safe house. Everywhere else, there'd be a million people outside my door. But when I left LA, even though it was for a short time, I felt far from everything. This worked. I felt better for a little while. I should have taken more advantage of it. It seemed like my relationship with the photographer was getting more serious, and as that happened, I sensed that my family was trying to get closer to me, in a way that made me uneasy. My mom called me one day and said, "Brittany, we feel like something's going on. We hear that the cops are after you. Let's go to the beach house." "The cops are after me," I said. "For what?" I hadn't done anything illegal. That I knew for sure. I'd had my moments. I'd had my wild spell. I'd been high on Adderall and acted crazy, but I didn't do anything criminal. In fact, as she knew, I'd been with girlfriends the prior 2 days. My mom and I had had a sleepover with my cousin Allie and 2 other girlfriends. "Just come to the house," she said. "We want to talk to you." So I went to the house with them. The photographer met me there. My mother was acting suspicious. When the photographer got there, he said, "Something's up, right?" "Yeah," I said, "something's really off." All of a sudden, there were helicopters going around the house. "Is that for me?" I asked my mom. "Is this a joke?" It wasn't a joke. Suddenly, there was a SWAT team of what seemed like 20 cops in my house. "What the fuck did I do?" I kept shouting. "I didn't do anything." I know I had been acting wild, but there was nothing I'd done that justified their treating me like I was a bank robber. Nothing that justified upending my entire life. I'd later come to believe something had changed that month, since the last time I was brought to the hospital for evaluation. My father had struck up a very close friendship with Louise Lou Taylor, who he worshipped. She was front and center during the implementation of the conservatorship that would later allow them to control and take over my career. Lou, who had just started a new company called TriStar Sports and Entertainment Group, was directly involved in calling the shots right before the conservatorship. At the time, she had a few real clients. She basically used my name and hard work to build her company. Conservatorships, also called guardianships, are usually reserved for people with no mental capacity, people who can't do anything for themselves. But I was highly functional. I had just done the best album of my career. I was making a lot of people a lot of money, especially my father, who I found out took a bigger salary than he paid me. He paid himself more than $6 million while paying others close to him tens of millions more. The thing is, you can have a conservatorship that lasts for 2 months and then the person gets on track and you let them control their life again. But that wasn't what my father wanted. He wanted far more. My dad was able to set up 2 forms of conservatorship, what's called conservatorship of the person and conservatorship of the estate. The conservator of the person is designated to control details of the conservatee's life, like where they live, what they eat, whether they can drive a car, and what they do day to day. Even though I begged the court to appoint literally anyone else, and I mean anyone off the street would have been better, my father was given the job, the same man who'd made me cry if I had to get in the car with him when I was a little girl because he talked to himself. And the court was told that I was demented, and I wasn't even allowed to pick my own lawyer. The conservator of the estate, an estate worth, in my case, tens of millions of dollars at one point, manages the conservatee's affairs to keep them from being subject to undue influence or fraud. This role was taken by my father in conjunction with a lawyer named Andrew Wallet, who would eventually be paid $426,000 a year for keeping me from my own money. I would be forced to pay upward of $500,000 a year to my court-appointed lawyer, who I wasn't allowed to replace. It felt like my father and Lou's employee, Robin Greenhill, ruled my life and monitored every move I made. I'm a 5'4" pop singer who calls everyone sir and ma'am. They treated me like I was a criminal or predator. There were times when I needed my father over the years and I reached out and he wasn't there. But when it came time for him to be the conservator, of course he was on the case. He's always been all about the money. I can't say my mom was that much better. She'd acted innocent while she was there for 2 sleepover nights with my girlfriends and me. She'd known the whole time that they were going to take me away. I am convinced that it was all planned, and that my dad and my mom and Lou Taylor were all involved. TriStar was even planning to be my co-conservator. Later, I learned that at the time they put me into the conservatorship, on the heels of his bankruptcy, my dad had been financially indebted to Lou, owing her at least $40,000, a lot for him, especially back then. That is what my new lawyer, Matthew Rosengart, later called a conflict of interest in court. Soon after I was brought to the hospital against my will, I was informed that the conservatorship papers had been filed. Chapter 30. As everything was falling apart for me, my mother was writing a memoir. She wrote about watching her beautiful daughter shaving off her hair and wondering how that was possible. She said that I used to be the happiest little girl in the world. When I made the wrong move, it was like my mother wasn't concerned. She would share my every mistake on television, promoting her book. She wrote it, trading on my name, and talking about her parenting of me and my brother and my sister at a time when all three of us kids were basket cases. Jamie Lynn was a pregnant teenager. Brian was struggling to find his place in the world and still convinced he was letting our father down. And I was in full meltdown. When the book came out, she appeared on every morning show to promote it. I would turn on the TV to see B-roll of my videos and my shaved head flashing on the screen. My mother was telling Meredith Vieira on the Today Show that she'd spent hours wondering how things went so wrong with me. On another show, the audience clapped when she said my sister was pregnant at 16. That was classy as shit, apparently, because she was still with the father. Yes, how wonderful. She was married to her husband and having a baby at 17. They're still together. Great. It doesn't matter that she's a child having a child. I was in one of the darkest times in my life, and my mom was telling the audience, "Oh, yeah, and here's Brittany." And every show was plastering images of me with my shaved head on the screen. The book was huge for her, and all at my expense. The timing was unfucking believable. I am willing to admit that in the throes of severe postpartum depression, abandonment by my husband, the torture of being separated from my two babies, the death of my adored Aunt Sandra, and the constant drumbeat of pressure from paparazzi, I'd begun to think in some ways like a child. And yet I look at the worst things I did during that time, and I don't believe the sum total of them is anywhere near as cruel as what my mother did by writing and promoting that book. She was on morning talk shows trying to sell her book about when I was in hospitals and being driven insane because I was separated from my babies for weeks on end. She was making money off that dark time. In those days, I wasn't the brightest bulb on the tree. It's the truth. But what plenty of people took away from my mother's book was, "Oh, Brittany's so bad." Her book even made me believe I was bad. And she did it at a time when I already felt so much shame. I swear to God, it makes me want to cry to think about my kids going through anything hard like I was going through when they were babies. If one of my sons were going through something like that, do you think I would write a book about it? I would fall to my knees. I would do anything I could to help him through it, to hold him, to make it better. The last thing I would do would be to cut my hair into a bob and put on a tasteful pantsuit and sit down on a morning show set across from Meredith fucking Vieira and make money off my child's misfortune. Sometimes I talk trash on Instagram. People don't know why I have such anger toward my parents, but I think if they were in my shoes, they would understand. Chapter 31. The conservatorship was created supposedly because I was incapable of doing anything at all. Feeding myself, spending my own money, being a mother, anything. So why was it that a few weeks later, they had me shoot an episode of How I Met Your Mother and then sent me on a grueling world tour? After the conservatorship started, my mom and my brother's girlfriend got short haircuts and went out to dinner drinking wine. Paparazzi were there taking their picture. It all felt set up. My dad took my boyfriend away and I could not drive. My mom and dad took my womanhood from me. It was a win-win for them. I remain shocked that the state of California would let a man like my father, an alcoholic, someone who'd declared bankruptcy, who'd failed in business, who'd terrified me as a little girl, control me after all my accomplishments and everything I had done. I thought about advice my father had given me over the years that I'd resisted, and I wondered if I'd be able to resist anymore. My father presented the conservatorship as a great stepping stone on the road to my comeback. Just months earlier, I'd released the best album of my career, but fine. What I heard and what my father said was, "She's great now. She's working for us. It's a perfect situation for our family." Was it great for me? Or was it great for him? How fun, I thought. I can go back to working again like nothing at all happened. Too sick to choose my own boyfriend and yet somehow healthy enough to appear on sitcoms and morning shows and to perform for thousands of people in a different part of the world every week. From that point on, I began to think that he saw me as put on earth for no other reason than to help their cash flow. At my house, my father took over my little study and my bar area and turned it into his office. There is a bowl there that had a bunch of receipts in it. Yes. Here's my confession. I was so nerdy that I kept all my receipts in a bowl. Each week, I would add up my expenses old school style to keep track of my deductions for taxes. Even when I was going through a wild spell, the fundamentals of who I was as a person were still there. To me, that bowl of receipts was proof that I was still capable of managing my affairs. I knew musicians who did heroin, got in fist fights, threw TVs out of hotel windows. Not only didn't I steal anything or hurt anyone or do hard drugs, I was keeping track of my tax deductions. Not anymore. My father shoved aside my bowl of receipts, setting up his things on the bar. "I just want to let you know," he said. "I call the shots. You sit right there in that chair, and I'll tell you what goes on." I looked at him with a growing sense of horror. "I'm Britney Spears now," he said. Chapter 32. On the rare occasion that I went out, like to my agent and friend Cade's house for a dinner party, the security team would sweep through the house before I arrived to make sure there was no alcohol or any drugs, even Tylenol there. No one at the party was allowed to drink until I left. The other guests were all very good sports about it, but I sensed that the second I left was when the real party started. When someone wanted to date me, the security team who answered to my father would run a background check on him, make him sign an NDA, and even have him submit to a blood test. And my father said I couldn't see the photographer I had been dating ever again, too. Before a date, Robin would tell the man my medical and sexual history. To be clear, this was before the first date. The whole thing was humiliating, and I know the insanity of this system kept me from finding basic companionship, having a fun night out, or making new friends, let alone falling in love. Thinking back on the way my father was raised by June and the way I was brought up by him, I had known from the jump that it would be an actual nightmare to have him in charge. The thought of my father taking over any aspect of my life had filled me with fear. But taking over everything? It was just the worst thing that could possibly ever happen to my music, my career, and my sanity. Pretty quickly, I called the weird-ass lawyer the court had appointed for me and asked him for help. Incredibly, he was all I really had, even though I hadn't chosen him. I had been told that I couldn't hire anyone new because my lawyer had to be court-approved. Much later, I would come to find out that was bullshit. I didn't know for 13 years that I could have gotten my own lawyer. I felt that the court-appointed lawyer didn't seem eager to help me understand what was going on or to fight for my rights. My mother, who is best friends with the governor of Louisiana, could have put me on the phone with him, and he would have told me I could get my own lawyer. But she kept it a secret. Instead, she got a lawyer for herself, just so she could get off on fighting with my dad like she did when I was younger. At various times, I pushed back, especially when my father took away access to my cell phone. I would be smuggled a private phone and try to break free, but they always caught me. And here's the sad, honest truth. After everything I had been through, I didn't have a lot of fight left in me. I was tired, and I was scared, too. After being held down on a gurney, I knew they could restrain my body any time they wanted to. They could have tried to kill me, I thought. I started to wonder if they did want to kill me. So when my father said, "I call the shots," I thought, this is too much for me. But I didn't see a way out. So I felt my spirit retreat, and I went on autopilot. If I play along, surely they'll see how good I am and they will let me go. And so I went along with it. After I'd married Kevin and had my kids, Felicia was still there a little bit. I had always adored her, but once I stopped touring and started working less, we fell out of touch. There was some talk of Felicia's coming back on board for the circus tour, but somehow I never did have her as my assistant again. I later learned that my dad told her I didn't want her to work for me anymore. But I never said that. If I had known she wanted to do something for me, I never would have told her no. Without my knowledge, my father was keeping her from me. I never saw some of my really close friends ever again. Still haven't to this day. It made me shut down psychologically even more than I had before. My parents had some old friends from home come visit me to make me feel better. "No thanks," I said. I mean, I loved them to death, but they had kids now and they'd moved on with their lives. Their coming to see me felt more like sympathy than a social call. Help is good, but not if it's not asked for. Not if it doesn't feel like it's a choice. It's difficult for me to revisit this darkest chapter of my life and think about what might have been different if I'd pushed back harder then. I don't at all like to think about that, not whatsoever. I can't afford to, honestly. I've been through too much. And when the conservatorship happened, it was true that I had been partying. My body couldn't physically take that anymore. It was time to calm down. But I went from partying a lot to being a total monk. Under the conservatorship, I didn't do anything. One day I was with the photographer, driving my car fast, living so much. Then all of a sudden I was alone, doing nothing at all. Not even always allowed access to my own cell phone. It was night and day. In my old life, I had had freedom. The freedom to make my own decisions, to set my own agenda, to wake up and decide how I wanted to spend the day. Even the hard days were my hard days. Once I gave up the fight, in my new life, I would wake up each morning and ask one question. What are we doing? And then I would do what I was told. When I was alone at night, I would try to find inspiration in beautiful or transporting music, movies, books, anything to help blot out the horror of this arrangement. Just as I had when I was a little girl, I'd look for other worlds to escape into. It seemed like every request went through my father and Robin. They decided where I went and with who. Under Robin's direction, security guards handed me prepackaged envelopes of meds and watched me take them. They put parental controls on my iPhone. Everything was scrutinized and controlled. Everything. I would go to sleep early, and then I would wake up and do what they told me again. And again. And again. It was like Groundhog Day. I did that for 13 years. If you're asking why I went along with it, there's one very good reason. I did it for my kids. Because I played by the rules, I was reunited with my boys. It was an ecstatic experience getting to hold them again. When they fell asleep next to me that first night we had back together, I felt whole for the first time in months. I just stared at them sleeping and I felt so, so lucky. To see them as much as possible, I did everything I could to appease Kevin. I paid his legal bills, plus child support, plus thousands more a month so the kids could come along with me on the circus tour. Within the same short period of time, I appeared on Good Morning America, did the Christmas tree lighting in Los Angeles, shot a segment for Ellen, and toured through Europe and Australia. But again, the question was nagging me. If I was so sick that I couldn't make my own decisions, why did they think it was fine for me to be out there smiling and waving and singing and dancing in a million time zones a week? I'll tell you one good reason. The circus tour grossed more than $130 million. Lou Taylor's company, TriStar, got 5%. And I learned, after the conservatorship, that even when I was on hiatus in 2019 and money wasn't coming in, my father paid them an extra minimum flat fee, so they were paid hundreds of thousands of dollars more. My father got a percentage too. Plus, throughout the conservatorship, about $16,000 a month, more than he'd ever made before. He profited heavily from the conservatorship, becoming a multimillionaire. My freedom in exchange for naps with my children. It was a trade I was willing to make. There is nothing I love more, nothing more important to me on this earth than my children. I'd lay down my life for them. So I thought, why not my freedom? Chapter 33. How do you cling to hope? I had resolved to go along with the conservatorship for the sake of my sons, but being in it was really hard. I knew there was something more inside me, but I felt it dimming every day. Over time, the fire inside me burned out. The light went out of my eyes. I know that my fans could see it, although they didn't understand the full scope of what had happened because I was so tightly controlled. I have a lot of compassion for the woman I was before I was put into the conservatorship when I was recording Blackout. Even though I was being described as so rebellious and such a wild girl, all my best work was accomplished during that time. All in all, though, it was a terrible time. I had my two little babies, and there was always a fight around my trying to see them. I look back now and I think that if I'd been wise, I wouldn't have done anything but focus on my life at home, as hard as it was. At the time, Kevin would say, "Well, if you meet me this weekend, we'll have a 2-hour meeting, and we'll do this, and we'll do that, and I might let you see the boys a little bit more." Everything was almost like a deal with the devil for me to get what I wanted. I was rebelling, yes, but I can see now that there's a reason why people go through rebellious times. And you have to let people go through them. I'm not saying that I was right to spiral, but I think to hinder someone's spirit to that degree and to put them down that much, to the point where they no longer feel like themselves, I don't think that's healthy either. We, as people, have to test the world. You have to test your boundaries to find out who you are, how you want to live. Other people, and by other people, I mean men, were afforded that freedom. Male rockers were rolling in late to award shows, and we thought it made them cooler. Male pop stars were sleeping with lots of women, and that was awesome. Kevin was leaving me alone with two babies when he wanted to go smoke pot and record a rap song, Popo Zao, slang for big ass in Portuguese. Then he took them away from me, and he had Details magazine calling him Dad of the Year. A paparazzo who stalked and tormented me for months sued me for $230,000 for running over his foot with my car one time when I was trying to escape from him. We settled and I had to give him a lot of money. When Justin cheated on me and then acted sexy, it was seen as cute. But when I wore a sparkly bodysuit, I had Diane Sawyer making me cry on national television, MTV making me listen to people criticizing my costumes, and a governor's wife saying she wanted to shoot me. I'd been eyeballed so much growing up. I'd been looked up and down, had people telling me what they thought of my body since I was a teenager. Shaving my head and acting out were my ways of pushing back. But under the conservatorship, I was made to understand that those days were now over. I had to grow my hair out and get back into shape. I had to go to bed early and take whatever medication they told me to take. If I thought getting criticized about my body in the press was bad, it hurt even more from my own father. He repeatedly told me I looked fat and that I was going to have to do something about it. So every day I would put on my sweats and I would go to the gym. I would do little bits of creative stuff here and there, but my heart wasn't in it anymore. As far as my passion for singing and dancing, it was almost a joke at that point. Feeling like you're never good enough is a soul-crushing state of being for a child. He drummed that message into me as a girl, and even after I'd accomplished so much, he was continuing to do that to me. "You ruined me as a person," I wanted to tell my father. "Now you're making me work for you. I'll do it, but I'll be damned if I put my heart into it." I became a robot, but not just a robot, a sort of child robot. I had been so infantilized that I was losing pieces of what made me feel like myself. Anything that my father or my mother told me to do, I would reject. My pride as a woman wouldn't let me take it seriously. The conservatorship stripped me of my womanhood, made me into a child. I became more of an entity than a person on stage. I had always felt music in my bones and my blood. They stole that from me. If they'd let me live my life, I know I would have followed my heart and come out of this the right way and worked it out. 13 years went by with me feeling like a shadow of myself. I think back now on my father and his associates having control over my body and my money for that long, and it makes me feel sick. Think of how many male artists gambled all their money away, how many had substance abuse or mental health issues. No one tried to take away their control over their body and money. I didn't deserve what my family did to me. The thing was, I accomplished a lot during the time when I was supposedly incapable of taking care of myself. In 2008, I won more than 20 awards, including a Cosmopolitan Ultimate Woman of the Year award. At the VMAs, just 1 year after I'd been mocked for my Gimme More performance, I won 3 Moon Men. My video, Piece of Me, won every category it was nominated in, including Video of the Year. I thanked God, my sons, and my fans for standing by me. I sometimes thought that it was almost funny how I won those awards for the album I made while I was supposedly so incapacitated that I had to be controlled by my family. The truth was, though, when I stopped to think about it for very long, it wasn't funny at all. Chapter 34. While overall I was miserable, day to day I was able to find joy and comfort in the boys and in my routine. I made friends. I dated Jason Trawick. He was 10 years older than me and really had his life together. I loved that he wasn't a performer but was an agent. So he knew the business and understood my life. We ended up dating for 3 years. When we went out together, he was hypervigilant. I knew I could be clueless sometimes. I'm not clueless anymore. Now I'm basically a CIA agent. He was always scoping everything out, obsessively controlling situations. I'd been around the paparazzi so much that I knew what was up. I knew the deal. So to see him in a suit, working at this huge agency, getting in the car with me, I felt he was almost too aware of who I was. He cared too much about managing things. I was used to photographers swarming me on the streets, and I hardly noticed them anymore, which I suppose isn't really good either. We did have a great relationship. I felt a lot of love for him and from him. I was still messed up psychologically from everything that had happened with Kevin and my kids, and from living under the strictures of the conservatorship my father had set up. I had a place in Thousand Oaks, California. My kids were young at the time, and my father was still in charge of my life. Even though I was on a break after the Femme Fatale tour, my father second-guessed every little thing I did, including what I ate. It puzzled me that my mom never said anything about it. My parents got back together in 2010, 8 years after their divorce. And I felt so betrayed by the state of California. My mom seemed to love that because of the conservatorship, my dad now had a real job. They watched Criminal Minds on the couch every fucking night. Who does that? When my father told me I couldn't have dessert, I felt that it was not just him telling me, but my family and my state. Like I was not allowed legally to eat dessert because he said no. Eventually, I started to ask myself, wait, where am I? Nothing really made sense anymore. Feeling like I needed more direction, I decided to go back to work. I tried to occupy myself by being productive. I began appearing on more TV shows, including in 2012 as a judge on The X Factor. I think a lot of people are really professional on TV, like Christina Aguilera and Gwen Stefani. When the camera is on them, they thrive, and that's great. I used to be able to do that when I was younger, but again, I feel like I age backward when I'm afraid. And so I got to where I was very, very nervous if I knew I had to be on air, and I didn't like being nervous all day long. Maybe I'm just not cut out for that anymore. I've accepted that now, and it's okay. I can tell people who try and push me in that direction no. I've been forced into things I didn't want to do and been humiliated. It's not my thing at this point. Now, if you got me a cute cameo on a fun TV show where I'm in and out in a day, that's one thing. But to act skeptical for 8 hours straight while judging people on TV? No thank you. I absolutely hated it. It was around that time that I got engaged to Jason. He got me through a lot of things. But in 2012, not long after he became my co-conservator, my feelings changed. I couldn't see it then, but I see now that having him tied up with the organization controlling my life might have played a part in draining the romance out of our relationship. There came a point when I realized I didn't have any bad feelings toward him, but I also didn't love him anymore. I stopped sleeping in the same room with him. I just wanted to cuddle my kids. I felt such a bond with them. I literally closed the door to him. My mom said, "That is hateful." "I'm sorry, I can't help it," I said. "I don't love him anymore like that." He broke up with me, but I didn't care because I'd fallen out of love with him. He wrote me a long letter and then he disappeared. He resigned as my co-conservator when our relationship ended. To me, it seemed that he had something of an identity crisis. He put colored streaks in his hair and went to the Santa Monica Pier and rode bikes every day with a bunch of tattooed dudes. Hey, I get it. Now that I'm in my 40s, I'm going through my own identity crisis. I think it was just time for us to part ways. The tours under the conservatorship were strictly sober, so we weren't allowed to drink. Once, I ended up with most of the same dancers as Christina Aguilera. The dancers and I met up with Christina in Los Angeles. She seemed pretty messed up. But the dancers and I wound up swimming in a beautiful pool and sitting in a jacuzzi. It would have been nice to have drinks with them, to get rebellious, sassy, fun. I wasn't allowed to do that because my life had become a Sunday school Bible church camp under the conservatorship. In some ways, they turned me into a teenager again. In other ways, I was a girl. But sometimes I just felt like a trapped adult woman who was pissed off all the time. This is what's hard to explain. How quickly I could vacillate between being a little girl and being a teenager and being a woman because of the way they had robbed me of my freedom. There was no way to behave like an adult since they wouldn't treat me like an adult, so I would regress and act like a little girl, but then my adult self would step back in. Only my world didn't allow me to be an adult. The woman in me was pushed down for a long time. They wanted me to be wild on stage, the way they told me to be, and to be a robot the rest of the time. I felt like I was being deprived of those good secrets of life, those fundamental supposed sins of indulgence and adventure that make us human. They wanted to take away that specialness and keep everything as rote as possible. It was death to my creativity as an artist. Back in the studio, I made one good song with will.i.am. Work, bitch. But I wasn't making a lot of music that I was proud of, probably because I wasn't into it. I was so demoralized. It seemed like my father would pick the darkest and ugliest studios to record in. It felt like some people got a thrill from thinking I didn't notice those things. I felt cornered in those situations. I felt they set me up. It was like they thrived on my fear, turned it all into drama, which in turn made me unhappy, and so they would always win. All I knew was I had to work, and I wanted to do the right thing, to make an album that I was proud of. But it was as if I had forgotten that I was a powerful woman. After the X Factor, my manager brought me the offer to perform as part of a Las Vegas residency. I thought, why not? My heart wasn't in recording music anymore. I wasn't passionately driven like how I used to be. I had no more fire to bring. I was so over it. I had two kids. I'd had a breakdown. My parents had taken over my career. What was I going to do at this point? Just go home? So I went along with it. I went to Vegas the way everyone goes to Vegas, hoping to win. Chapter 35. I loved the dry heat of Las Vegas. I loved the way everyone believed in luck and the dream. I had always enjoyed it there, even back when Paris Hilton and I were kicking off our shoes and running through casinos. But that felt like a lifetime ago. My residency started right after Christmas in 2013. The boys were 7 and 8. In the beginning, it was a great gig. Being on stage in Vegas was thrilling at first, and no one would let me forget that my residency was a landmark deal for the Strip. I was told my show drew young people back to Sin City and changed the landscape of entertainment in Las Vegas for a new generation. The fans gave me so much energy. I became great at doing the show. I got so much confidence, and for a while, everything was good. As good as it could be when I was so tightly controlled. I started dating a TV producer named Charlie Ebersol. To me, he seemed like marriage material. He took great care of himself. His family was close. I loved him. Charlie worked out every day, taking pre-workout supplements and a whole bunch of vitamins. He shared his nutrition research with me and started giving me energy supplements. My father didn't like that. He knew what I ate. He even knew when I would go to the bathroom. So when I started taking energy supplements, he saw that I had more energy on stage and that I was in better shape than I had been. It seemed obvious that Charlie's regimens were a good thing for me. But I believe my father started to think that I had a problem with those energy supplements, even though they were over-the-counter, not prescription. So he told me I had to get off them, and he sent me to rehab. He got to say where I went and when. And going to rehab meant that I didn't get to see my kids for a whole month. The only consolation was that I knew it was just for a month and I'd be done. The place he chose for me was in Malibu. That month, for hours a day, we had to do boxing and other exercises outside because there was no gym. A lot of people at the facility were serious drug addicts. I was scared to be there by myself. At least I was allowed to have a security guard who I'd have lunch with every day. I found it difficult to accept that my dad was selling himself as this amazing guy and devoted grandfather when he was throwing me away, putting me against my will into a place with crack and heroin addicts. I'll just say it, he was horrible. When I got out, I started doing shows again in Vegas like nothing had happened. Part of that was because my father told me I had to get back out there. And part of it was because I was still so nice, so eager to please, so desperate to do the right thing and be a good girl. No matter what I did, my dad was there watching. I couldn't drive a car. Everybody who came to my trailer had to sign waivers. Everything was very, very safe. So safe I couldn't breathe. And no matter how much I dieted and exercised, my father was always telling me I was fat. He put me on a strict diet. The irony was that we had a butler, an extravagance, and I would beg him for real food. "Sir," I would plead, "can you please sneak a hamburger or ice cream to me?" "Ma'am, I'm sorry," he would say. "I have strict orders from your father." So for 2 years, I ate almost nothing but chicken and canned vegetables. 2 years is a long time to not be able to eat what you want, especially when it's your body and your work and your soul making the money that everyone's living off of. 2 years of asking for French fries and being told no. I found it so degrading. A strict diet you've put yourself on is bad enough. But when someone is depriving you of food you want, that makes it worse. I felt like my body wasn't mine anymore. I would go to the gym and feel so out of my mind with this trainer telling me to do things with my body, I felt cold inside. I felt scared. I'll be honest, I was fucking miserable. And it didn't even work. The diet had the opposite effect of what my father wanted. I gained weight. Even though I wasn't eating as much, he made me feel so ugly and like I wasn't good enough. Maybe that's because of the power of your thoughts. Whatever you think you are, you become. I was so beaten down by all of it that I just surrendered. My mom seemed to go along with my dad's plan for me. It was always incredible to me that so many people felt so comfortable talking about my body. It had started when I was young. Whether it was strangers in the media or within my own family, people seemed to experience my body as public property. Something they could police, control, criticize, or use as a weapon. My body was strong enough to carry 2 children and agile enough to execute every choreographed move perfectly on stage. And now here I was, having every calorie recorded so people could continue to get rich off my body. No one else but me seemed to find it outrageous that my father would set all these rules for me and then go out and drink Jack and Cokes. My friends would visit and get their nails done at spas and drink fancy champagne. I was never allowed into spas. My family would stay in Destin, a pretty beach town in Florida, at a ridiculously beautiful condo that I bought for them and eat good-tasting food every night while I was starving and working. Meanwhile, my sister was turning her nose up at every gift I'd given the family. I called my mom one day in Louisiana and said, "What are you doing this weekend?" "Oh, the girls and I are going to Destin tomorrow," she said. Jamie Lynn had said so many times that she never went there that it was one of the more ridiculous things I'd bought the family that she'd never wanted, and it turned out my mom went there every weekend with Jamie Lynn's 2 daughters. I used to love buying my family houses and cars. But there came a point when they started to take things for granted, and the family didn't realize that those things were possible because I'm an artist. And because of how they treated me, for years I lost touch with my creativity. I was given an allowance of about $2,000 a week. If I wanted a pair of sneakers that my conservators didn't think I needed, I would be told no. This was despite the fact that I did 248 shows and sold more than 900,000 tickets in Vegas. Each show paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of the only nights that I went out with a friend and others, including my dancers, for dinner, I tried to pick up the check for our whole party. The check was $1,000 because the group was so big, but I had wanted to take them out. It was important to me that they knew how much I appreciated how hard they worked. My purchase was declined. I didn't have enough money in my allowance account to cover it. Chapter 36. One thing that brought me solace and hope during the time when I was in Vegas was teaching dance to kids at a studio once a month, and I loved it. I taught a group of 40 kids. Then back in L.A., not far from my house, I taught once every 2 months. That was one of the most fun things in my life. It was nice to be in a room with kids who had no judgment. In the conservatorship, people were always judging everything I did. The joy and trust of kids the age of the ones I taught, between 5 and 12, is contagious. Their energy is so sweet. They want to learn. I find it 100% healing to be around children. One day there, I did a turn and accidentally bonked a tiny little girl in the head with my hand. "Baby, I am so sorry," I said. I felt so bad that I got on my knees in front of her. I pulled a ring off my finger, one of my favorite rings, and gave it to her while begging her forgiveness. "Miss Brittany, it's fine," she said. "You didn't even hurt me." I wanted to do anything I could to let her know that I cared if she was in pain, and that I would do whatever it took to make it up to her. Looking up at her from my knees on the dance studio floor, I thought, wait a minute. Why are the people who are charged by the state with my care not half as interested in my well-being as I am in this little girl's? I decided to make a push to get out of the conservatorship. I went to court in 2014 and mentioned my father's alcoholism and erratic behavior, asking that they drug test him. After all, he was controlling my money and my life. But my case didn't go anywhere. The judge just didn't listen. What followed was a cloak-and-dagger effort to get my own lawyer. I even mentioned the conservatorship on a talk show in 2016, but somehow that part of the interview didn't make it to the air. Huh. How interesting. That feeling of being trapped contributed to the collapse of my romantic life. After a stupid fight, Charlie and I got so prideful that we stopped speaking to each other. It was the dumbest thing. I couldn't bring myself to talk to him, and he had too much pride to talk to me. That's when I started working with two great songwriters, Julia Michaels and Justin Tranter. We'd sit and write everything together. I had passion about it. It was the one thing in the 13 years of the conservatorship that I really put my heart into. I worked hard on the songs, which gave me confidence. You know, when you're good at something and can feel it, you start doing something and think, I got this. Writing that album gave me my confidence back. When it was done, I played it for my sons. What should I name the album? I asked. My kids are really smart about music. Just name it Glory, Sean Preston said. And so I did. Seeing the kids so proud of that album meant a lot to me. I thought, I'm proud of this too. It was a feeling I hadn't had in a long time. I released the video for Make Me, and I went on the 2016 VMAs to perform in support of it for the first time since 2007. The first time I saw Hisam Askari on the set of my video for Slumber Party, I knew I wanted him in my life immediately. I was instantly smitten. The chemistry with us in the beginning was insane. We couldn't keep our hands off each other. He called me his lioness. Right away, the tabloids started to say that he was cheating on me. We'd been dating 2 weeks. We stayed with each other. I started to feel my spark returning. Then my dad decided he had to send me to treatment again because I'd snuck my over-the-counter energy supplements. He thought that I had a problem, but he showed mercy and said I could be an outpatient there so long as I'd go 4 times a week to Alcoholics Anonymous. At first I resisted, but the women I met there began to inspire me. I'd listen to them telling their stories and I'd think, these women are brilliant. Their stories were actually very, very profound. I found a human connection in those meetings that I'd never found anywhere before in my life. And so at the beginning, I really liked it. But some of the girls didn't always show up. They could pick and choose meetings they wanted to go to. I had no choice in the matter. Friends I met there might only go 2 times a week, or they'd go to a morning meeting one day and an evening meeting the next day. I wasn't allowed to switch it up at all. I had the same meetings at the same time every week, no matter what. After an exhausting run of shows, I came home, and my sons, my assistant, my mom, and my dad were there. "Time for your meeting," my dad said. "Is there a way I can just stay home right now and watch a movie with the boys? I never missed one meeting," I said. I had never watched a movie with my kids at home in Vegas. I thought we could pop popcorn and have a nice time together. "No, you have to go," he said. I looked at my mom, hoping she would stand up for me, but she looked away. At that moment, I started to feel like I was in a cult and my father was the cult leader. They were treating me like I was beholden to him. But I was so good, I thought, reflecting on how hard I'd worked in those shows. I wasn't good. I was great. It was a line that would run through my mind repeatedly over the next couple of years when I thought about the ways in which I had not just met but exceeded the expectations that had been set for me, and how unfair it was that I still wasn't free. I'd worked so hard and kept up the schedule they set for me. Basically, 4 weeks on, 4 weeks off. When I was on, I did 3 2-hour shows a week. And on or off, I also kept the weekly schedule they set for me. 4 AA meetings, 2 hours of therapy, and 3 hours of training a week, plus fan meet and greets and 3 shows. I was burned out, and I wanted to control my own destiny. One hairdresser caught a glimpse of my schedule, and she said, "Oh, honey, what are you doing?" She had 2 little girls and was very maternal. I liked her a lot. "You think it's too much?" I asked her. "It's more than too much," she said. "That's insane." She leaned in like she had a secret to tell me. "Listen," she said, "in order to be creative, you have to have room for play in your schedule. It helps ground you to have that time to yourself. Hell, to just stare at the wall if you want. People need that." It must have gotten back to my father what she'd said, because the next day, someone else was doing my hair. I never saw that hairdresser again. Chapter 37. As performers, we girls have our hair. That's the real thing guys want to see. They love to see the long hair move. They want you to thrash it. If your hair is moving, they can believe you're having a good time. In the most demoralizing moments of my Las Vegas residency, I wore tight wigs and I'd dance in a way where I wouldn't move a hair on my head. Everyone who was making money off me wanted me to move my hair, and I knew it, and so I did everything but that. When I look back, I realize how much of myself I withheld on stage, how much by trying to punish the people who held me captive, I punished everyone else too, including my loyal fans, including myself. But now I know why I'd been sleepwalking through so much of the past 13 years. I was traumatized. By holding back on stage, I was trying to rebel in some way, even if I was the only one who knew that that was what was happening. And so I didn't toss my hair or flirt. I did the moves and I sang the notes, but I didn't put the fire behind it that I had in the past. Toning down my energy on stage was my own version of a factory slowdown. As an artist, I didn't feel able to reach the sense of freedom that I'd had before, and that's what we have as artists. That freedom is who we are and what we do. I wasn't free under the conservatorship. I wanted to be a woman in the world. Under the conservatorship, I wasn't able to be a woman at all. It was different, though, with Glory. As the Glory singles rolled out, I started getting more passionate about my performances. I started to wear high heels again. When I wasn't trying so hard and I just let myself elevate as a star on stage, that's when it came across the most powerfully. And that's when I could really feel the audiences lifting me up. Promoting Glory, I began to feel better about myself. That third year in Vegas, I got a little bit of fire back. I started to appreciate the dazzle of performing in Sin City every night and the spontaneity of feeling alive in front of an audience. Even though I might not have been doing my best on stage, there were pieces of me that began to awaken again. I was able to tap back into that connection between a performer and an audience, I have trouble explaining to people who haven't been on stage what it's like to sense that current between your physical body and the bodies of other human beings in a space. The only metaphor that really works is electricity. You feel electric. The energy runs out of you and into the crowd and then back into you in a loop. For such a long time, I'd had to be on autopilot. The only current I could access was whatever was inside of me that kept me moving. Slowly, I began to believe in my capabilities again. For a while, I didn't tell anyone. I kept it a secret. Just as I escaped into my dreams to get away from the chaos of my parents when I was a little girl, in Las Vegas, now as an adult but with less freedom than I'd had as a child, I began to escape into a new dream. Freedom from my family and a return to being the artist I knew I had in me. Everything began to seem possible. Hisam and I became so close that we started to talk about having a baby together. But I was in my 30s, so I knew that time was running out. At the beginning of the conservatorship, I was overwhelmed with doctor appointments. Doctor after doctor after doctor, probably 12 doctors a week, coming to my home. And yet, my father wouldn't let me go to the doctor when I asked for an appointment to get my IUD removed. When the conservatorship happened, everything became controlled, with security guards everywhere. My whole life changed in a way that might have been safer for me physically, but was absolutely horrible for my sense of joy and creativity. A lot of people said, "Oh, your life was saved." But no, not really. It's the way you look at it. It's perspective. My music was my life, and the conservatorship was deadly for that. It crushed my soul. Before the conservatorship, I'd been in and out of studios recording. During the conservatorship, a team of people kept track of when I was going to use the toilet in the recording studio. I'm not even kidding. I read after the conservatorship that my father and Robin, at Lou Taylor's company TriStar, had been involved with the security company they hired, Black Box, in monitoring and reviewing calls and texts coming out of and going to my cell phone, including private texts with my boyfriend, my lawyer at the time, and my own kids, and worse, that my father even had a bug put in my home. In my own home. This was all part of their control. I'd left home as a teenager because my family life was so terrible. All those times at 4 o'clock in the morning when I had to go out into the living room as a little girl and say, "Shut up, Mama," as my father lay passed out drunk in his chair. Those times would come back to me at 4 in the morning when I woke up and stared at the ceiling, wondering how those people had come to be in charge again. In those quiet moments in the middle of the night, I swore to do everything I could to escape. Chapter 38. That third year in Vegas, I felt something within me that I hadn't felt in a really, really long time. I felt strong. I knew I had to do something. Once I started to return to myself, my body, my heart, my physicality, and my spiritual self couldn't take the conservatorship any longer. There came a point when my little heart said, "I'm not going to stand for this." For so long, my parents had convinced me that I was the bad one, the crazy one, and it worked completely in their favor. It hurt my spirit. They put my fire out. I undervalued myself for a decade. But inside, I was screaming about their bullshit. You have to understand the helplessness in that. The helplessness and the anger. After my shows, it made me so mad to see my family drinking and having a great time when I wasn't even allowed a sip of Jack and Coke. In the public eye, I know I looked like a star on stage. I had cute tights on and high heels, but why the fuck couldn't I sin in Sin City? As I became stronger and entered a new phase of my womanhood, I started to look around for examples of how to wield power in a positive way. Reese Witherspoon was a great example to me. She's sweet and she's nice, and she's very smart. Once you start to see yourself that way, not just as someone who exists to make everyone else happy, but someone who deserves to make their wishes known, that changes everything. When I started to think that I could be, like Reese, someone who was nice but also strong, it changed my perspective on who I was. If no one is used to you being assertive, they get very freaked out when you start speaking your mind. I felt myself turning into their worst fear. I was a queen now and starting to speak up. I imagined them bowing down to me. I felt my power surging back. I knew how to carry myself. I'd become strong, enduring that kind of schedule. I really had no choice but to be strong, and I think audiences perceived that. It speaks volumes when you demand respect. It changes everything. And so when I heard my conservators trying to tell me, once again, that I was stupid if I tried to turn down a performance or find a way to give myself more time off, I felt myself revolt. I thought, if you guys are going to trick me into feeling bad for saying no, I'm not going to fall for it again. The residency was set to end December 31st, 2017. I couldn't wait. For one thing, I was so sick of doing the same show week after week for years. I kept begging for a remix or a new number, anything to break up the monotony. I'd started to lose the joy in performing that I'd felt when I was younger. I no longer had the pure, raw love of singing that I'd had as a teenager. Now other people were telling me what to sing and when. No one seemed to care about what I wanted. The message I kept getting was that their minds mattered. My mind was to be ignored. I was just there to perform for them, to make them money. It was such a waste. As a performer who has always taken so much pride in her musicianship, I can't stress enough how mad I was that they wouldn't even let me change up my show. We had weeks in between each set of shows in Vegas. So much fucking time was wasted. I wanted to remix my songs for my fans and give them something new and exciting. When I wanted to perform my favorite songs like Change Your Mind or Get Naked, they wouldn't let me. It felt like they wanted to embarrass me rather than let me give my fans the best possible performance every night, which they deserved. Instead, I had to do the same show week in and week out, the same routines, the same songs, the same arrangements. I'd been doing the same kind of show for a long time. I was desperate to change it up to give my wonderful, loyal fans a new and electrifying experience. But all I heard was no. It was so lazy, it was actually odd. I worried about what my fans would think of me. I wished I could communicate that I wanted to give them so much more. I loved to go to studios for hours at a time and do my own remixes with an engineer. But they said, "We can't put remixes in because of the time code of the show. We would have to redo the whole thing." I said, "Redo it. I'm known for bringing new things to the table." But they always said no. When I pushed, the best they could offer me, they said, was to play one of my new songs in the background while I was changing. They acted like they were doing me a huge favor by playing my favorite new song while I was underground, frantically taking costumes on and off. It was embarrassing because I know the business. I knew it was totally possible for us to change up the show. My father was in charge and it wasn't a priority for him. That meant that the people who would need to make it happen just wouldn't do it. Singing such old versions of songs made my body feel old. I craved new sounds, new movement. I feel now that it might have scared them for me to actually be the star. Instead, my dad was in charge of the star. Me. When I did the videos for the singles from Glory, I felt so light and so free. Glory reminded me what it felt like to perform new material and how much I needed it. When I was told I'd be receiving the first ever Radio Disney Icon Award the year after Glory came out, I thought, this is great. I'll take the boys and wear a cute black dress, and it will be a lot of fun. Well, as I sat in the audience seeing a medley of my songs performed, I had so many feelings. By the time Jamie Lynn made a surprise appearance to do a bit of Till the World Ends and to hand me my award, I was a ball of emotion. The whole time I was watching the show, I kept flashing back to the concert special I'd done for In the Zone. It was a remixed ABC special. I had rehearsed for a week and sung several new songs. They shot me so beautifully. I felt like a kid. Frankly, it's some of my best work. There was a cabaret vibe to a sultry rendition of Baby One More Time, and then for every time I wore a pretty white dress. It was just really, really beautiful. It had felt so incredible to be at that stage of my career, free and performing my music my way with so much creative control. And sitting there to receive the Icon Award at the Radio Disney Music Awards, even while I was honored by the performances, I was furious. Here were three singers and my sister doing new arrangements, something I had begged for 13 years, having fun with my songs in a way I hadn't in hundreds of performances, and I was sitting there having to smile. Chapter 39. Before the conservatorship, my friend and agent Cade would call me up and say we should go on a road trip, and I'd be in the car before he was done telling me where we were going. If I wanted the volume cranked up at one of my shows, I'd politely make sure the sound guy turned it up. If you pissed me off, everybody would know about it. I was a little badass. But in Vegas, I just smiled and nodded and did the same show again and again like a wind-up doll. The only thing that kept me going was knowing that I'd have two vacations with my kids, as I did every year. But the year that Glory came out, I had to tour instead, which meant I wasn't allowed to go on vacation.